may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest is Jonathan Etherton, the president and owner of Etherton & Associates, a firm that provides services in federal relations to clients in the defense, intelligence, aerospace, and services industry. John has a long background working on the Hill. He spent 18 years there, from 1981 to 1999, and in particular, he spent 14 years, I believe, on the Senate Armed Services as a professional staffer to the Senate Armed Services Committee. John, it's great to have you here. Good morning.
Thank you, Roger.
And John, you know, it's with your congressional background, there's that 60, I don't know if it's right number, $63 billion question out there. Is are we going to have a shutdown or not? What do you think?
Well, I think this week obviously is going to tell the tale. I think that certainly a shutdown is a lot more likely prospect than it was just even a couple weeks ago. It seems like both sides have dug themselves in a little bit in terms of the House and Senate. I did read reports during the recess that at a lot of the town meetings, the freshman Republican congressmen in particular were getting a lot of strong feedback from their constituents that they prefer to see a shutdown rather than to allow government spending to continue at current levels. So I think we will see how this all works out. It seems like both sides are still pretty far apart, and as soon as one side makes a move, it seems like the other side's ready to jump up and summarily reject it. So I think over the next couple of days, we'll see if we can do that, or if people will step back from the precipice.
It's interesting, and you know, looking at your background, I know you're on an authorizing committee, so you weren't, you know, dealing with those budget numbers, but still you were up there. Can you just sort of describe a little bit for the listeners, you know, that dance that goes on or this negotiation? I mean, because you were there up on the Hill when I was working for the GSA at the time and actually was directed to go home for about 6 days, but you were up on the Hill when this was all going down during the 90s, Sorry. No,
and I guess it was somewhat of a misfortune. I was declared an essential employee and had to come to work every day.
That's too bad. I was not.
But what I remember about it is that as time went on, there was a certain attitude about it at the beginning, as different sides sort of had a perception of how the action would be perceived, who would be blamed, who would see it as a good thing. And as the days went on and people saw the impact of shut down national parks and shut down museums and the impact on, you know, certain payments and services that the agencies were providing, that picture gradually shifted quite a bit, and it got to the point where the pressure really started to mount for folks to try to make a deal. But my recollection is we actually had two separate periods where the government shut down, and one of them lasted over 20 days.
That's right, yeah.
And so it was one of those things where everybody sort of had to take the journey. And we got to the end of it, and people finally realized that, you know, making the deal was the thing to do.
Yeah, do you think the atmosphere? I mean, the atmosphere is different this time. I mean, it seems to me there was a lot of budgetary pressure back then,
right?
But now we're in a situation where I think it's even more severe. And if you're telling us that you've seen these reports where, you know, these freshmen are getting, you know, feedback from their constituents on it's time to hold the line. Do you think it's a little different dynamic, or a little, you know, the camps are a little bit more already sort of entrenched in their positions than last time at this point?
I think that the general feeling, if you talk to any individual members of Congress, at least most of them, everybody would like to avoid a shutdown if at all possible. Obviously, the price of that for individuals is different as you talk to individual people. But I was struck in reading some of the accounts of the town meetings by how well informed the constituents were about what had been going on, even on the floor of the House or Senate, in terms of individual votes that the members had taken. And it really struck me how much the internet now seems to be a factor in the debate. People don't have to wait to get a copy of the printed congressional record, right, you know, and read the account. They can go and do it almost in real time. And I think that's going to be an additional factor in the dynamic. I think that there'll be a lot of feedback back and forth going into it. And I guess the real question I have is the degree to which how much do the leaders in both the House and Senate really control the rank and file, so that if there is some will, at least at the top, to reach some sort of a deal, will that be sellable to the rank and file, or will there be a series of cascading negotiations which could draw this process out for a while?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've already seen, right, on the House side, yeah, where the leadership doesn't, there's the folks, the freshmen that you were just talking about, to I think, for example, voted against the second engine,
right?
You know, and so there is. It seems like there is there's a dynamic where these folks have a mind of their own. So, with that in mind, and we're going to turn to acquisition reform in a moment or two. But just, you know, since we're on the budget, can you just sort of what do you think, or how do you think these budget impacts are playing on discussions around acquisition reform, the plans, we have DOD doing their better buying initiative, mm-hmm, and all those things. How is this all playing together? I think it's something that the dynamic there and the moving pieces are quite interesting.
I think it is, and I think if I were to characterize one thing that I think this year is a little bit different even than last year, is the dominant role of the budget considerations in a lot of these discussions. I think that any proposals for further reforms of the acquisition process or new initiatives for better management, the first question that people have is how much is it going to cost first, and then how much money will it save? And while I think those were always issues that people had an interest in, they really are becoming the dominant issues, I think, in the discussions. And I do believe that the budget discussions will have an impact in a couple ways. One will be obviously on the process. I think clearly any discussion of an FY12 budget process will have to be deferred until that we have some reasonable resolution of what the FY11 numbers look like. I think as we get into April, it looks like we'll have the debt ceiling issue sort of, if all those issues are still open, I think it's going to be an interesting mix to see how that all plays together. But I think that will delay a lot of considerations of some of these other things.
So we could theoretically, right, with the debt ceiling issue, have another, I don't want to use the word standoff, but you have another vigorous debate around,
right,
the priorities in the budget and that sort of thing, and that budget ceiling will be used as a sort of a marker for both sides, I think, to make their, positions known.
That's the indications that we have right now, and I think that one of the questions I've got is whether this FY11 process that we're talking about this week continues to be unresolved to the point where the debt ceiling issue then comes into play, and how those two will work together.
Well, we can't run a deficit here, so we have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more with John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we're going to turn our attention to the prospects for acquisition reform, what's in store on the Hill, or what may not be in store in the coming year. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Almost 70 years ago, a well-known Connecticut native named Homer Cummings had a dream to start a Washington law firm devoted to working at the intersection of America's business and government. As Attorney General for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was an integral part of the New Deal. In 1956, Gilbert A. Cuneo joined Cummings' firm to begin what was quickly to become the largest and most successful government contract practice in the country, earning him the title the Godfather of Government Contracts. That same firm, McKenna, Long & Aldridge, today is recognized by Chambers USA as a Tier 1 government contract law firm, continuing its preeminence in the field through its offices in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Denver, and San Diego. With the oldest and largest government contracts practice in the United States, McKenna, Long & Aldridge still operates at the intersection of business and government. They produce solutions by working with their clients on creative and flexible strategies that ensure success. Their attorneys and professionals include former members of government, Congress, and its committees, so they know how Congress thinks and they understand how Washington works. There is no aspect of government contracts with which they are not familiar. In this uncertain economic climate, clients trust them to deliver solutions at costs that represent real value. From one new deal to another, they have remained at the forefront of government contracting. McKenna, Long, and Aldrich, a name you can trust.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jonathan Etherton of Etherton Associates, and we've been talking about the budget, at least in the first session, but right now I think it's time to turn a little bit to one of my favorite topics, acquisition reform. I know it's John's as well. So, just turning away from the budget, is there energy still on the Hill? You know, we've had what seems like a decade of acquisition reform and, lest I say, micromanagement on a part of the Hill in terms of a lot of acquisition policies. Is there still energy there for more action on the Hill?
Roger, I think there is. If you talk to the staff and some of the members now, and you say, well, what plans do you have for acquisition reform, especially on the legislative side, the answer that you get typically now is, oh, we're going to do oversight this year. We don't have much plans for acquisition policy for the legislation. Last year, I heard the same thing, and if you look at the defense authorization bill, there are more acquisition policy provisions in that bill in one place than we've seen in several years.
Yes, you're right about that.
So I think there'll be a number of different factors which will probably drive the debate further. I do think there will be a lot of oversight. The committees are still in the process, at least in the Senate, of getting organized. But I do think that we'll see a lot of oversight. We've had indications from several of the House committees that that will be a major focus of their oversight. The House Armed Services Committee posted their oversight plans on their website, and you can see acquisition policy is still a big issue for them. But here's the things that I think will be driving it. We've seen a large number of acquisition policy provisions passed over the last couple of years. Probably most notably is the Weapons Systems Acquisition Reform Act of 2009. That was signed into law. It'll be 2 years in May, so I think it's appropriate now, and I think the committees feel this way, to really start looking into how well that's been implemented, what sort of lessons learned do we have in terms of the requirements, whether things need to be adjusted. So I think that will be a subject of some oversight and discussion on the Hill. We have a couple of pending rules.
John, sorry to interrupt, but do you have a sense for what the committee may or may not find with regard to the implementation of WSARA?
I think the one area that they really, at least I've been told, they really want to focus in on is life cycle cost management. There is a provision in there that requires, and I think it's Section 202, that requires preserving the option of competition throughout the supply chain as part of your acquisition planning. And I know that there's been a lot of interest in that, and I think in operation and support costs generally, and what actions are being taken to control that. So that's one area in particular that I think people really will want to look into.
Yeah, and I was interrupting you on another thought.
The point I wanted to make is there are a number of pending rules that we expect to see published in the Federal Register relatively soon. Two of the most notable ones will be the government-wide rule on organizational conflicts of interest, and the other rule will be on work reserved for federal employees. We're likely to see a new version of the OFPP proposed policy letter. That may also drive, because some of that was driven by some of the things that happened on Capitol Hill, then I think it'll be a point-counterpoint. So I think those kinds of things may drive at least some oversight agenda activity in this area.
Yeah, and I know industry, when was that, Mayor Brown, when the DFARS rule implementing the Weapons Systems Acquisition Reform Act came out with regard to organizational conflicts of interest, when that came out, and that included essentially a whole rewrite of DOD's organizational conflict of interest policies. And what they did there, though, in the final rules is step back from that
right.
And just focus on implementing the statute.
Correct.
So it's a great point that, and I know a lot of that was congressionally inspired, I believe.
Right.
So it's a great point that when that comes out, it'll be interesting, the rewrite of the FAR, proposed rewrite of the FAR 9.4 Organizational Conflict of Interest Regulations. It'll be interesting to see what the congressional reaction to what's proposed is. With that in mind, do you sense or how do you feel about whether or not Congress and the administration are working together on a lot of these acquisition issues, or are there a different dynamic now that you have the House controlled by Republicans?
I think a little bit of that remains to be seen. It was really interesting to me to see, especially starting in 2009, the degree to which there was almost a synergy between the executive branch and the congressional side on a lot of these issues, where one branch of government would sort of play off the activities of the other, and they would simply go back and forth to see who was really going to take the lead. I think now with the changed political lineup, we may see a little more friction, especially on the oversight side. I think the oversight agenda of some of the House committees will probably be somewhat more critical of some of the things that the Obama administration may be doing, although in the acquisition area has generally tended to be less partisan, as I think people are just striving to figure out the things that work best for the taxpayer. But I think we could have a little more friction in the whole process this year than we've had in the
past. I'll ask you about one area in particular, insourcing versus outsourcing, if you want to touch that. But that seems to me, you know, just looking at it from stepping back, an area where there might be different views on how to approach that issue.
Well, I think if you look at last year's bill, in Title III in the authorization bill, they at least attempted to lay out a framework of how the Department of Defense, at least, was supposed to approach the whole insourcing issue, when it was appropriate to do cost comparisons, what would be the basis for those, and what the expectations were. I think that the OFPP policy letter that we expect to see pretty soon will try to address the broader framework in the context of inherently governmental functions, and critical positions. Actually, ironically, I think this is one area where, at least in my discussions with folks in industry and on Capitol Hill as well, that we may be able to reach some sort of a modicum of an understanding about how, going forward, the whole blended workforce should be managed. And those decisions should be made to protect the interests of the taxpayer and the agencies on the one hand, and yet provide, where appropriate, if there's an appropriate role for industry in these various activities, how to lay that out in a more long-term, sustained fashion. So I think this is an issue. It'll be interesting, but I do think that there may be some way of working through this year.
Yeah, it's one of those issues. I know in talking to some folks, there still remains great concern about small businesses in particular, and how they're impacted on the government's decision whether to insource or out. And you know, John, I just have to think back and recall. You know, we John and I met on the Sarah panel. Now 4, 5, 6 years ago, and one of the issues that the Sarah panel did focus on is this blended workforce and trying to straighten it out and get a consensus around what makes sense for the taxpayer, for industry, for government as a whole. So it's kind of gratifying to see something actually sort of, in a certain sense, potentially working to a solution. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. But with that, we have to take a break. When we return, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. We're going to talk a little bit more about what reform prospects are on the Hill. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
What do successful small, medium, and large federal contractors, including two-thirds of the top 100, have in common? Membership in the Coalition for Government Procurement. Successful federal contractors know they get the information edge they need on developing acquisition trends and an effective voice to protect their interests from coalition membership. For nearly 30 years, the Coalition's been the trusted voice of industry, working with federal officials to promote common sense procurement. Know what the best know. Join the Coalition today to protect and grow your company's business. Contact the Coalition at 202-331-0975 or visit their website at thecgp.org. That's 202-331-0975 or thecgp.org. Don't be left wondering what will happen to your federal business. Contact the Coalition today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we're talking to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we've been talking about a little bit about the budget, a little bit about acquisition reform and oversight, and just picking back up on oversight and reform, I guess yesterday, I believe, the Commission on Wartime Contracting issued their second interim report, and I think there's a lot of good stuff in there. John, what's your take on it, and what do you think it means on the Hill?
Well, I think it will certainly be a source of issues for folks to do oversight on, and maybe even there are actually some specific legislative proposals, especially in Section 5, for at least folks to consider. There isn't language. There's no language or anything else in it. But a couple of the issues that they try to address in there is the extension of the business systems rule that currently is working through the Department of Defense. They'd like to see that extended to the civilian agencies as well, which I think will stir a lot of controversy and feeling. And I think another area that they've also indicated that should be considered is the getting better access to contractor records by the audit agencies, including internal audit information, and that's been an issue that's been very controversial for quite a while. So I think that, and when they come out with their final report, which I understand will be sometime probably in the late spring, early summer, will be another source, I think, of ideas for people to look at as they consider either further oversight or even further legislation.
You know, John, I know you can comment on this or not, but you know, when you tell me about the business systems rule and that commission, I guess one of the things from my government experience that I always sort of like I scratched my head about and said, is taking and I wouldn't say it's a worst case scenario, but taking a situation which is not the norm. Wartime contracting, for example, and taking lessons from that, and then applying it to a system that's in a non-wartime environment. Does that make sense or not? It's sort of like regulating by anecdote and going to the worst and regulating to the worst case scenario. I don't know whether that makes sense or not. I don't know if you want to touch that or not.
No, I'll touch it. I think you're right. I mean, I think that's always a concern. I think the burden is really on the folks who want to try to make a connection between those very specific extreme cases and the more general situation, and I don't think that's been done always in the past when people look at these things. Clearly, in the case of the business systems rule, that I think was partly driven by some of the earlier work of the Commission on Wartime Contracting. It's caused a lot of consternation because obviously, you've got resource constraints for folks to try to administer that. You've got timeliness issues and a number of other issues that come up when you're talking about giving the government the authority to withhold funds, based on deficiencies and things like that. So,
Let me ask you another topic area, too, just real quick, and that is a 3% withholding rule.
Right.
I know there's been a couple bills dropped, I think one in the House and mm-hmm. one in the Senate. And for
right.
folks, what that is there's a law out there right now that hasn't been implemented. I think it's been, again, delayed for another year till 2012 that would require government entities that I think contract for over $10,000. I think that's the right number. They would have to withhold 3% of the dollars under those transactions essentially to ensure that the contractor's taxes are fully paid. I mean, that's a layman's way to describe it. It's like tax withholding for government contractors, a whole new program. And I know it causes great concern, not just in industry, but also in government. Many state and local governments have grave concerns their ability to actually manage it and the costs associated with it. And there have been two bills dropped, I think, to repeal it. What do you think the prospects are for that?
The problem with repeal is it gets scored, and you have to pay the scoring for it if you want to get it repealed. And the last estimate I saw was something like $6 or $7 billion that you'd have to come up with in either additional revenue or other budget cuts to buy it. The last strategy that was used with the issue was to delay it. But right now, the prospects for a lot of legislation moving through Congress this year, I don't think are all that great. And there's a lot of concern because this does now go into effect starting on January 1 of next year, and people have to start getting systems in place to administer it. So that if a decision is made to delay it or repeal it without having the consequences of having people starting down a road and spending the money on implementation, that decision will have to be made pretty soon. I know there was an effort to try to get it added to the FAA reauthorization bill in the Senate.
Yes, I saw that. Yep.
And it was not successful, but I think there'll be continuing efforts to try to do that. But we are reaching at some point, I think this year, a point of no return in terms of how we do it. Clearly, it could be changed. But we're reaching a point where people are spending money now to try to cope with the prospect.
Right? Yes, people got to create systems to
right.
implement it and that sort of thing. And again, here, I think this, in my view, this is another example where, sort of legislating or whatever to a worst case situation and, taking a sledgehammer to something that, it's not going to work out. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it.
Well, and the other issue is the administration cost of it, which some calculations I've seen actually are more than what you'd actually
right. It's going to cost money to
right.
actually implement as
right.
opposed to actually save the government money.
Right.
So that's interesting. You know, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I just wanted to, I mentioned in the previous session that John and I were members of the SAIR panel that issued its report to Congress and OMB back in 2007. And there's been a lot of activity on those recommendations. And I just want to get your perspective, how you think, looking back, do you think we had it about right? And do you think Congress has done the right thing in following up on those recommendations and OMB? Because some have been implemented regulation, some have been done by statute.
I think there were a couple of very good things that happened from that effort. And the one that I am most proud of is the degree to which people really focused on the need to increase the capability and the size of the acquisition workforce, especially in the Department of Defense. We had paid lip service when I used to work on the Hill as a staff member. We paid lip service to that subject year after year after year, and nothing much really happened with it. And I think the SAIR panel report really helped give the impetus, for example, to set up the Acquisition Workforce Development Fund for the Department of Defense that has really, I think, had a pretty significant impact on increasing the capability and the numbers of people in the defense acquisition workforce. And now there are some prospects of actually expanding that to the civilian agencies as well. Some of the other areas that we looked at, I think, are kind of a mixed bag. I think the report is still of interest. People are still looking at it. I hear references, for example, to the interagency contract section. Folks are looking at some of the other issues in there. So I think it was a useful effort. But I think the biggest impact, and I think probably from the standpoint of the system, probably the most important one that had to happen, was the impact on the acquisition workforce question.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with you. And because you hear, Shay Assad and folks at DOD talk about investing in the workforce, and, now they have some resources to be able to do that.
Right.
So that's a good thing. Now, I want to thank my guest, John Etherton, for joining today on the show. John actually will be moderating a panel at the Coalition for Government Procurement's Spring Conference, March 17th. We're going to have a congressional panel. Jonathan is going to be our moderator. We're going to have some folks there talking about what's going on the Hill again. We have a great lineup. Shay Assad will be there. So we're looking forward to that. Thank you for doing that, John. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I'm Roger Waldron.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal Managers Association invites all federal managers, supervisors, and executives to its 73rd National Convention and Training Seminar, Federal Managers Turning Policy into Action. On Tuesday, March 15th in Arlington, Virginia, federal managers will gather for engaging presentations including Hiring Reform, What It Means to Managers, The Future of Supervisory Training, and Managing a Telework Workforce. For more details, visit fedmanagers.org. That's fedmanagers.org.
Connect with Federal News Radio wherever you are. Like us on Facebook to see the hottest news stories on your wall. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fednewsradio. Download our free iPhone app. Just go to the App Store and search for Federal News Radio. And now, connect to the radio station straight from your cell phone. Just call 712-432-6616. Go to federalnewsradio.com and search for social media for details.
WFED Washington, WW